You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Mainstream Democrats and liberals are still scratching their heads and coming up with a wide range of explanations for why Hillary Clinton lost last November and then the further losses in four special elections in June. What have Republicans and conservatives figured out that the liberals are missing? Columbia University Humanities Professor Mark Lilla has called for a new political vision repeatedly since the 2016 election, an argument he details in a new book, The Once and Future Liberal, After Identity Politics. It's published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased it has brought Mark Lilla to our show. Welcome.
Good to be here.
You published an essay headed The Liberal Crack-Up in the Wall Street Journal just last Friday. What's the crack-up?
Well, the crack-up is that we've lost the country. Over two generations, we've lost the ability to articulate a vision of where we want to take the country, of what the country stands for, and with a kind of hopefulness about the country. And so ever since Reagan's election, I think we've gone missing. We've abdicated in the contest for the American imagination.
You also wrote an op-ed called The End of Identity Liberalism for the New York Times shortly after the election. What's identity liberalism?
Well, identity liberalism is what grew up after Reagan's election. What happened, I like to think of 20th century American political history in terms of, so far, of two dispensations. There was, let's call the first the Roosevelt dispensation. So after the Gilded Age, Roosevelt and the New Dealers came along with
them. Oh, I didn't know which Roosevelt you were
from. Oh, sorry, yeah.
After the Gilded Age.
Yeah, yeah. The FDR and the New Dealers came out with a vision that was very different of what we are as a nation. And it was based on two principles. It was based on solidarity, social solidarity, and among all citizens, and equal protection. And that dispensation, also reinforced by the experience of the Second World War, set the terms of political debate up until the 70s. I mean, we have to, and even Republicans had to work within it. You know, people forget that Richard Nixon was the first to propose a minimum income for all Americans and also health care, because it was assumed the government has to do this. But then we lost our, and then Reagan came along, and with a different dispensation, it says, forget all that. We're a nation essentially of individuals, families, and churches. Government just gets in the way. The way we'll flourish is by getting government off our backs. There's nothing wrong with the American people, and we're a shining city on the hill. And now that dispensation's over.
In the past, didn't Democrats have to make concessions to win support for liberal reforms like the New Deal from Southern Democrats?
Yeah, and that was a huge problem. You know, there's a great book by my colleague Ira Katznelson about that, about how very subtly and not so subtly, the Dixiecrats manage to disenfranchise African Americans from the New Deal, effectively, from the programs that we had.
In fact, for a long time, the Democrats were the party of segregation. The Republicans were the party of desegregation, Republicans being the party of Lincoln. Woodrow Wilson segregated the federal government.
Yeah. And, you know, it's what you call a filthy compromise. The only way to get any New Deal was to have the Dixiecrats on board.
In an American Prospect article published yesterday, Robert Kuttner reported on his interview with Steve Bannon, in which Bannon said, if the left is focused on race and identity, and we, the Republicans, go with economic nationalism, we can crush the Democrats. Could Democrats make economic issues work for them? Weren't they often seen as the party of labor, the American worker?
Yeah, that's happened. I mean, in the public imagination, we've gone from being the unfairly with that from the party of Joe Sixpack to the party of Jessica Yogamat, right? That's the way people think about us now. But Bannon, I think, is right. He has no reason to lie about this. But what's important is that our economic message fall into a framework of what we stand for in our basic principles. It's not just that we want more economic growth so people can have jobs. We believe in a principle, which is solidarity, and that we have a stake in making sure people are protected and have jobs.
In your Wall Street Journal essay, you wrote, quote, "Every advance of liberal identity consciousness has marked a retreat of liberal political consciousness." What do you mean by that?
Well, it's true, as Bannon suggests, that talking about identity issues stirs up his base. But the real problem with our focus on identity politics is that we've gotten a sort of movement politics into a movement politics identity, where there are a series of movements, each of which are very pure about their issue. They only care about their issue. And we've taken our eye off the ball, which is to articulate a large vision of what we are.
Aren't white nationalism and white supremacism the original identity crisis?
Absolutely.
And weren't the right-wing extremists in Charlottesville focused on identity?
Absolutely. But what changed in the 70s is that we tried to fight fire with fire, and that's a losing proposition for us.
And you say that Black Lives Matter is a textbook example of how not to build solidarity. Why? Isn't it a response to violence against black people?
Do you have the next sentence in the book in front of you or not?
Well, no. I don't have the next sentence.
Okay. Well, then in the next sentence in the book, I say that that Black Lives Matter at first delivered a wake-up call to every American with a conscience. And I thought that it was fantastic. But then, as is typical when you're involved in movement politics, is that you radicalize your message, you develop an indictment of all of America and of our police force, and that ends up putting a barrier between you and the people that otherwise you could persuade.
Hasn't it been through debate over identity and politics that problems of institutional racism have been recognized?
Absolutely. In order to understand the problems in this country, you have to take identity into account. You don't have a picture of what's going on. But in order to do something about them, you need to seize power. It's not enough just to talk about these things. It's not enough to speak truth to power. You have to seize power to defend the truth, and that requires winning elections.
Mark Lilla's latest book is The Once and Future Liberal, After Identity Politics. It has nothing to do with King Arthur. It is published by Harper. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. Can identity consciousness and political consciousness be compatible?
Well, identity consciousness, again, in terms of understanding our problems, is absolutely necessary. But it's come at the cost of losing a sense, I think, in the Democratic Party, that if we don't win elections, we can't help the people we say we want to help. And so we've taken our eye off the ball. We are not competitive. Let me give you an example. We now have, thanks to movement politics, a right to abortion in this country. And there are large swaths of the country where a woman cannot get an abortion. No legal briefs, no amount of texting, no amount of marketing is going to change that. What will change that? It's when Democrats and liberals and progressives go to those states and start winning local elections, congressional seats, governorships. Right now, the Republican Party controls two-thirds of the houses. They control two-thirds of the governorship. Someone just told me that, well, and they control 24 states, and they could call a constitutional convention. That's the barrier to serving the people we care about.
Well, isn't that partly because they were very clever after the last census and figured out how to use it to gerrymander?
Well, how do you gerrymander? You gerrymander by controlling the state legislature. And so if you're not competitive—
But sometimes Democrats have controlled the legislature, sometimes Republicans have. They happen to do it at the right time.
Right, because they also have governorships, and often they had Republican presidents who would back them up and not take them to court over it.
A few months ago, the New York Times ran an article that argued that if liberals want to change the country, they should move to Iowa.
Well, if they don't do it physically, they have to do it in their heads. Look, you know, what I want to encourage young activists to do is to get out from behind their computers and go out there. You know, you got to go to places where the Wi-Fi sucks, where you have no desire to take a picture of your dinner, and you're eating with people who are bowing their heads in prayer in thanks for that dinner. You need to take a big humility pill and go out there. And you've got to convince them that the principles you care about will help them.
Something that's often cited is that whites will constitute less than 50% of the government in fewer than 50 years. Is time, I mean, that angers a lot of the white supremacists, the white nationalists, but is time on the Democrat side, given how the country's demographics are changing?
Absolutely not, and for three reasons. One is that we have more and more mixed-race people in this country, and they tend, over time, to vote more white, to think of themselves as white, except for African Americans. Another reason is that as certain minority groups become economically successful and get older, they become more Republican. And the third reason that we can't wait for demographics is that the states that we would need to win, the places where they're not allowing women to get an abortion, are places where people are religious and white.
With right-wing extremists becoming a major part of their base, are Republicans and conservatives facing identity problems of their own?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the reason we're getting this now is, you know, I was thinking about that this weekend. Why weren't we seeing these marches when we had a black president? And we didn't. Instead,
there were a lot of attacks on him for being black.
But nothing. Look, we didn't have people marching into Thomas Jefferson's university before his statue with burning torches. And the reason is that we have a president who has emboldened them. And he has defeated, essentially, the Republican Party. He brought an end to the age of Reagan.
Are the Republicans making an effort to appeal to non-white ethnic groups?
Oh, it's
Asians,
it's,
Latinos?
Yes, of course. And also young people. I'm on all these terrible email lists to see what's going on in the right, and there are youth groups that are formed. But it's going to be really hard after what happened in Charlottesville.
Don't all people identify themselves in one way or another? When does a focus on identity become a problem?
Well, it becomes a problem for us when people don't identify as citizens and as citizens first. If we stress difference, it's very difficult to make an appeal to someone if we don't stress if we don't all identify as equal citizens.
But didn't James Madison warn about factions? So that was a long time ago. Have the politics of identity been evolving since the country was founded?
Well, factions are different. I mean, factions can also be interest groups, right? They're just interested in certain things, or you have labor versus industry. It's not always about identity.
Do Americans tend to think that if another group is gaining, they must be losing?
That's exactly our problem, that by stressing identity all the time, we've effectively given the right an opening to say, okay, everything's about identity. So now let's rally around our side, and it's a zero-sum game. And Democratic politics, you know, on the left, has always been arguing there's no zero-sum game, that we're all in this together.
My guest is Mark Lilla, professor of the humanities at Columbia University, author of a number of books. The one we are discussing, his most recent, The Once and Future Liberal, After Identity Politics. It's published by Harper. Stay with us for more. We're back with Mark Lilla. His latest book, The Once and Future Liberal, After Identity Politics, published by Harper. Doesn't the term liberal cover a wide range of political views, not always consistent with one another?
Well, I would hope so. I mean, the way in which a political ideology captures the imagination of the country is that lots of different people of lots of different interests see themselves in the message and see themselves in the word.
So should we see a distinction between words like liberal and progressive?
People use the term
or the left
in different ways, right?
Yeah. The conservatives use the word left to cover pretty much anybody who is slightly left of center.
Right. I think some of these distinctions are useful. I mean, Hillary Clinton was a centrist liberal, and Bernie Sanders was a progressive. And so there are different emphases there that are worth paying attention
but
to.
But hasn't the Democratic Party tended to exclude progressives like Bernie Sanders?
Well, yeah, partially, because, frankly, because we've been so focused on identity and we've become an elite party, we have not been focused on economic issues the way he has been.
And it's often suggested that Bernie Sanders might have beaten Trump. Are Bernie Sanders and progressives doing something right as far as you're concerned?
They're doing something very important, which is actually reaching out and trying to deliver a more general message. My problem with progressives is that everything progresses with them except their economic theory. And so they end up talking about the economy like we're still back in the 30s. And, you know, I don't find convincing a lot of their arguments about what to do about the global economy. I share their worries about it, but I feel that they need to modernize their view and their message about just where we are in the world economy.
On the other side of the political spectrum, how distinct is conservatism from the extremism that we saw last weekend in Charlottesville?
Yeah, well, my last book, which came out last year, is called The Shipwrecked Mind on Political Reaction, and I study what reaction is. And to tell you the truth, the Republican Party has become entirely a reactionary party. Conservatism doesn't exist anymore as a serious force.
Conservative actually means conserving what is good in society.
Well, exactly, and paying attentions to norms and protocols, and also the conservative vision has always been that society is kind of organic, and that is not what the Republicans believe.
Have Republicans or conservatives capitalized on divisive identity issues with their talk of law and order, immigration, political correctness, and similar issues?
Well, we have to beware of putting our guard down about that. I mean, certainly law and order can be a code word, but there's also law and there's also order. And there are African-American neighborhoods where black leaders have been very concerned about law and order in their area. So we don't want to throw those things out.
It's just how the law and order is maintained.
Exactly.
That concerns a lot of people.
Right. And so I guess my approach is that we want to seize the terms and put a different spin on them, not deny that they're real.
Donald Trump's approval rating has dropped steadily. Could he, in effect, shed light on extreme conservatives and move swing voters to the Democrats?
That's what one would hope. And what I don't want us to do is to step on this opportunity. And that's why I'm worked up about the Antifa movement, is that after the march and after the killing of this poor woman, I think a lot of America was taking notice and was seeing that there's a problem there. But if you fall in love with the romance of righteous violence and simply want to go from place to place and break heads and break windows, you're going to drive people away.
In surprisingly, a number of people in the extreme right have celebrated the death of Heather Heyer.
Oh, my God. It was disgusting. I mean, one of the things I saw on the internet was a picture from behind of the car plowing into the crowd and bodies flying. And under it, it said, "How do you like my car?"
What's your view of the removal of statues and monuments now underway in areas in the South? And I guess in the North as well, we just heard about some in Brooklyn.
Mm, yeah. Look, in general, I think we misdirect our energy if we spend our time denouncing the dead. But this is not about the dead. This is about now. The moment that these symbols become actual and mobilize fascists the way they do now, they have to go. It's that simple.
There was an article in Today's Times by Nathaniel Englander about how he thought that the anti-Semitism that he experienced when he was a kid, was dead. So he was kind of stunned by some of the things that he's seen recently.
Yeah, and it was a quite moving—
Nathan Englander.
Yeah, it was a very moving article because he began just talking about all the incidents of people rolling pennies at him and things like that. And yeah, we thought that was gone. It's not.
The extreme right and the supporters of Donald Trump still do form a diminishing percentage of Americans. Shouldn't that translate into political wins for Democrats and liberals?
Look, the situation we're in is we're a visionless country right now. There's a vacuum. The Republicans' old vision, the Reagan vision, no longer convinces anyone, and we don't have a vision of our own. So the task is to seize the imagination of the country again before the Republicans do.
Donald Trump and others keep on pointing out that some of the mistakes that Hillary Clinton made, like not campaigning in Wisconsin, Michigan, and statements about the deplorables, were reasons that she lost, although she did win a majority of the votes. What could she have done that was different?
Well, there were so many things. I mean, you can never pin the blame of an election loss on any one thing. But you know, she made one mistake, I think, and that was at every campaign stop, she would call out to particular identity groups. Now, in general, there's nothing wrong with saying we support women, we support blacks, we support Latinos. But she didn't mention everyone. She did not mention churchgoers in the South. She did not mention women who don't consider themselves feminists, and on and on. And if you're going to get in the business of listing people, you better list everyone. So my view is get out of the job of listing people and speak in more general terms about what we share as citizens.
My guest is Mark Lilla, professor of humanities at Columbia University, author of a number of books about politics and related matters. His latest, the one we're discussing, The Once and Future Liberal, After Identity Politics, published by Harper's. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So how should Democrats and liberals address the diversity of their political base while also trying to appeal to voters in the political center? How would they politics that's less dependent on identity approach programs like affirmative action, which has come under attack again recently?
Exactly. Well, affirmative action is a good example, you know, because if we think of affirmative action as simply being about, as the way, you know, many white voters think it's about, that it's simply about giving goodies to another group and taking goodies away from them. But there's a principle below affirmative action, and that is that we need to incorporate and enfranchise everyone as a citizen. And if you are locked out of jobs, if you are locked out of a college education, you cannot fully participate as a citizen. And that needs to be our message, not an identity message, but a principled message.
I just read statistics that indicate that while Asian Americans are upset that they are, to some degree, they see themselves as victims of affirmative action, it's assumed that that African Americans are the ones who benefit, but it turns out it's mostly wealthy white people who benefit the most.
How do you mean that?
Well, they're the ones who want, if Asian Americans are denied places in colleges, who fill those seats?
Yeah, I think that's part of the problem. If we conceive it as many colleges are now, affirmative action more in terms of class, a general disadvantage, we'd be better off. But the problem is, you see, let's say you have a list of 100 people who are admitted into college, and because of an affirmative action, numbers 101 and 102 get in. Who drops out? Well, 99 and 100. But those tend to be people who also come from relatively disadvantaged backgrounds. I think that the cost of affirmative action should be borne by every class, and so the people in the top 10 should also pay the price.
Haven't conservatives worked to suppress voting in poorer Democratic areas? Does that suggest that some form of identity liberalism is needed?
No, on the contrary. We have to go and win those states in order to prevent that. We need governors, and we need attorneys general, and we need judges that are going to enforce the law and will not gerrymander against us. No, on the contrary, we have to move, turn 180 and give a more general message where we can win in those states.
Would it be different if we had a parliamentary system?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, certainly. Yeah, it would be for this important reason, that if you have a parliamentary system, you can actually we could focus here on the two coasts, right? And just rally our people, and we'd have a majority. Hillary Clinton won. But American federalism forces you to go out right? And it's not just the Electoral College. It's that state and localities hold a lot of power. So the system was set up to force people not to just focus on one group or one geographical area, but you have to win the entire country.
Populist movements have surged in Europe. Is there also a kind of identity liberalism there?
There isn't. I mean, you see a little bit of it in England, but it's a very different story. And, you know, I wanted to mention...
It's illegal in some countries. In Germany, now you can't make certain statements about other groups.
That's right. Now you're seeing... It's interesting. The march in Charlottesville for the right was quoting two things that are going on in Europe. To begin with, marching through a university with torches is a direct quotation of the march by Nazi students in May 1933 into the campus of the University of Berlin where they burned the books. They're referring to that. Second, this slogan, "You will not replace us," that is a slogan on the European right right now. There's this theory that there's a great replacement, that immigration, that elites are letting immigrants in to replace white people. And so they're listening to each other, you know, right and the American right.
Although the slogan here was "Jews will not replace us." How did they see Jews replacing them?
Oh, because they think Jews control everything. Right? It's not that the Jews in terms of population, but that the Jews are going to let in other people and disadvantage them.
You said that you focused too much on the people of the past. Wasn't Yale persuaded to rename a college that had been named after John C. Calhoun, the pro-slavery 19th century politician? Was that a bad thing?
Actually, I was of mixed minds about it, but I've decided that I think it was a good thing. I mean, one of the interesting things, it was named quite late for reasons that are not good reasons. And he was a theorist of this, right? But take another example. There was an effort to rename the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton because he didn't hold all the views we hold today about race. That's a problem.
Well, he was an out-and-out racist, actually. Implemented segregation in the federal government and did a really Eric Foner's now talking about a new reconstruction.
No, absolutely. But that was not all he did. I mean, Calhoun was only about that. Woodrow Wilson also was a progressive in every other way.
So when Donald Trump says George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were slave owners, shouldn't we pull down their statues? Isn't he putting up a false equivalency?
Oh, absolutely. But it is true that it's a misdirection of our energy to go into the past and give people marks and determine how we're going to talk about them, whether they're going to be recognized for other things.
Can liberals or progressives do anything to persuade conservatives to change their minds? Or vice versa, for that matter?
Well, you know, as I've been trying to say, and as I argue in my book, the way to appeal to these conservatives is to offer a message based on principles that would actually affect them. For example, why did they vote for, among the reasons they voted for Donald Trump is because of American trade policy and the fact that we weren't taking care of American workers. Now, that's an opportunity for us to say, right, that's what Republicans do. What we do is we stand for solidarity among all of us as citizens, so we will stand behind you.
A number of scholars and observers have argued that our political system is becoming less democratic and more oligarchical. Would you agree? And might that explain more about why Democrats are losing?
How would they be? Oh, because I see what you mean. Yeah, no, that's absolutely
true. The money of the Koch brothers, the Mercers.
Yeah, but it's more the 1% and the half of the 1%. It's definitely become a more oligarchic society like that. All the more reason to get our stuff together.
The legal scholar Jack Balkin has argued that we're suffering from what he calls constitutional rot. Government is less responsive to the people and officials are less committed to the public good.
I think that's true. I think that's true. And people have lost confidence. That's what's most dangerous is when people lose confidence in these institutions. You know, the reason Weimar fell apart, it wasn't just that there were the Nazis. It was also that the left lost confidence and people on the far left would not work with socialists and social democrats, abandoned parliament, went to the streets, and that's where they lost.
I should also point out that Hitler never won, didn't win a majority until after he gained power.
Nobody did pretty well, that's for sure. Well,
he got 30-something percent initially. Larissa McFarquhar in The New Yorker made the point that people in many rural areas feel that they're ignored or even looked down on by people in Democratic strongholds like New York or Boston or Los Angeles. But they don't seem to be upset in large numbers that their Republican representatives don't want to hold town halls now.
That's right. But here we're talking about cultural symbols, and I think that's what Larissa was talking about as well, is that, you know, they voted for Donald Trump, but he is, as someone said, a poor man's view of a rich man. He somehow vibrates with them. I grew up in Macomb County, Michigan. It's famous among Democrats because it was the home of the Reagan Democrats. In the early 60s, it was blue collar, totally blue collar. In the early 60s, it was the most liberal county in the United States. In 1972, it went for Nixon and never turned back. I saw that happen in my neighborhood.
In my family. Their politics.
And it was a cultural reaction. That's what it was.
And the cultural reaction was that Richard Nixon somehow represented them better?
No. It was
than
a reaction.
David Humphrey?
It was a reaction against what had happened in the 60s with students and all the rest. I was an altar boy. And I served at a lot of funerals of kids in the neighborhood who died in Vietnam. And a lot of liberals have grown up in places where no one ever served. And I saw that. And imagine the reaction of seeing people on television spitting on the flag that just draped your son's coffin. I mean, there's no better way to turn people off than that.
We have to leave it there, unfortunately. We've run out of time. Mark Lilla, his latest book is The Once and Future Liberal After Identity Crisis of Politics, published by HarperCollins. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for inviting me.